welcome to this Wednesday's edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming in the second half of today's show, we'll have our weekly chat with Rick Guillen as he joins me for another edition of Prairie Plates. We'll hear Rick's interview with Beth Dooley. She's a James Beard-winning cookbook author from the Twin Cities, and she'll set the table for us to discuss regional food authors. But first, we bring you our second part of our discussion on Measure 4, the property tax question that will appear on this November's ballot and, if passed, would eliminate valuation-based property taxes in North Dakota. Yesterday, we heard Governor Doug Burgum's perspective opposing a ballot measure that aims to eliminate property taxes in North Dakota. Today, we're joined by Dr. Rick Becker, chairman of the End Unfair Property Tax Campaign, to discuss why he supports the measure. Dr. Becker, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks for being with us. Measure 4, which has been officially now approved by the Secretary of State's office, will be on the ballot this November. And I want to start, Dr. Becker, with a quote on your website that says you emphasize that the measure, and I quote here, changes the source of funding for local services without reducing or eliminating that funding. And you assure voters that, and I quote again, we will not lose the services or providers we need. Let's dive into that. Why this route to change the property tax question in North Dakota?
Well, yeah, it's such an important question. I was a legislator for 10 years, and I think that most elected officials are fully aware that the number one complaint amongst North Dakotans is the property tax. And when I delved into a little bit further, I'd identify three areas that I think are the main concerns. Number one is the valuations. People many times don't agree with the valuations. It's sometimes frustrating, don't do anything to your house at all. And yet the valuations go up, which means your taxes go up. But yet the local elected officials say that's not from them raising taxes, which is true. So that can be very frustrating. It's also a tax on unrealized gains. So maybe your home value went up, but that doesn't mean you have more money, you're not making more money to pay more taxes. A second component is that very, very few people, in fact, I would say even the minority of legislators, and certainly not a significant majority of city and county commissioners, fully understand how we do property tax. How do we go from full and true value to assessed value to taxable value? How do we determine mill levies, and how is that applied to the different classes of property? Very few people can answer that. It's really, in my mind, concerning that one of the three main ways that we tax people, and the only way in which someone could lose their house if they can't afford the increasing taxes, is a tax that nobody understands. So how can we have true transparency and true access as a taxpayer to go and, I guess, lodge our complaints or concerns if we don't even understand it? And then the third thing is, it's really so unfortunate when someone is forced to move out of their house, or their house has been foreclosed on, or business has been foreclosed on, because they are on either a fixed income and can't afford the ever-increasing taxes, or they just fell on hard times, and you only have 2.5 years before the county starts to foreclose. So you asked why the measure and how it is. First off, in our North Dakota Constitution, it's already there that says the state cannot levy a valuation-based property tax. So naturally, that's the proper place to put in. Neither the state nor any local subdivision can levy a valuation-based property tax. So that's what's in there. Nobody, starting next year, can levy a valuation-based property tax. So what that accomplishes is many of the concerns I just listed. No more valuations, no more mill levies, nothing's confusing. So the locals, when they do taxing, are going to have to go to a different method. And that's what you brought up from our website. We are changing the method of taxation that locals do for the services they provide. A second part of the measure is the state must replace to every political subdivision, so city, county, township, school district, every single dollar. It says the state shall replace no less than what was levied in 2024. And that's what the 2024 levy is, what we have been getting in the mail about the estimated property tax. So it's what we pay in 2025. So that's another complaint, by the way. People, and I think in large part, believe that the state has a tremendous amount of revenue and that the state legislature is overspending. It has a spending problem. So this forces the state to take some of that excess revenue, that wasteful spending, that corporate welfare, meaning the taxpayer dollars being given to private industry, private businesses, special interest groups, and convert it back to true tax relief for North Dakota citizens.
Rick, the governor said, and I quote here, who gets the biggest relief? The biggest metro areas is what he claimed. Rural areas pay almost no property tax. They're getting no relief. What's your response to that?
My response is actually, it's an interesting comment. I think it's a little bit silly because what happens is everyone who pays property tax is getting a huge break because everything you pay now, you keep in your pocket going forward every single year. So there are more homes in more populated areas. And so by a dollar amount, there will be more relief because there's more people. For every 100 people that live in a very rural area, they will get the same break as every 100 people that live in an urban area. So I'm not sure this is somehow, I think, an attempt or a misunderstanding, perhaps, which pits, I guess, urban versus rural, east versus west, Fargo versus the rest of the state. And there's a lot of that from the opposition. But I think it's very, very simple. No matter where you live, every dollar you are spending in property tax right now is going to be covered by the state forevermore. And your local elected officials will be able to levy the taxes they need for any amount above what the state is replacing. Because the state is replacing a flat amount. They don't determine the amount. They don't get to. There are no strings attached. So there is no additional state control. They just need to pass it on to every political subdivision.
Governor says that it doesn't change or lower the cost of delivering anything in the state. It just shifts the burden to someone else. In other words, we're also going to pay essentially the same. So why this proposal?
Yeah, well, that would only be true if you believe that there is no wasteful spending in the state. Because when we keep that money that we're paying currently in property taxes in our pocket, that is to our benefit. Now, there are other states looking to eliminate property taxes. Michigan, for instance, they would like to eliminate their property tax, and to do it, they're planning to increase their sales tax. Now, there you have a situation where Governor Burgum would be correct. You're paying for it one way or the other. North Dakota is in a very unique situation where we have so much revenue per capita. Our spending increases over the last 15 years are double on a per capita basis, are double all of the other states' average. So we are overspending so much. We have that extra money. We can do that property tax relief. So for instance, in the past, the state has done property tax buy downs. And nobody was complaining about that. Now they didn't work, and they economically speaking, we should have known that. In fact, I did know that, because the property tax structure, the mechanism, is still in place. And if you don't change the structure, the true reform just can't happen because whoever you're giving a break to, somebody else is picking up the slack. For instance, wind farms were given a big tax decrease this year. Railroads, big tax decrease this year. Now, when that happens, let's say that your local elected officials kept the budget the same. They were doing their due diligence. They didn't want to increase your taxes, so they kept their spending level the same. The problem is, because the state gave the railroads and the wind farms big tax breaks, we have to pick up the slack for that spending level to be the same. So currently, the situation is so unfair. The locals have so little control. This huge reform to the way we do the taxes redounds to the benefit of every single citizen in the state.
Dr. Becker, the governor would also say, and I think you've heard and you address it on your website, that local control is kind of a baseline issue here. So if a local community, a local school district decides we need a new elementary school, the folks in the community think that's a good idea, but the state doesn't. What about the local control question in that example?
Well, that's a red herring example, because what if the state, first off, why would the state care? Secondly, if they did care, where do they come in this transaction?
Let me ask this question then. If we didn't have property taxes to assess to build the new school, somebody would have to be giving the money to build the new school, wouldn't that be the state?
No, not at all. See, the reason, and this is very important, I'm glad you asked, there is no loss of local control, zero. In fact, there is so much of a lack of control for local elected officials with property tax, pages and pages of restrictions in our century code from the state. when we move away from property tax, they actually get more control. There's no longer a one size fits all. But the reason I can say that there is no loss of control whatsoever is because, again, the state replaces a flat amount, everything that was levied in 2024, with no questions asked. So I think we can all agree that that money then is transferred over and no control is given to the state. The question comes in and the misunderstanding comes in when we say, what about the money that they need above that level in the future because we know prices for things increase? Here's what the situation is. We're not looking to the state for that. The only way to retain local control is for the locals to make the budgets like they always have. They're 100% in charge of their budgets. There's no asking legislature for money. There's no coming to Bismarck to beg for money. They set their budgets. They know they're getting this very huge chunk from the state that replaces everything we're currently paying in property tax. And the amount they need above that, they will need to levy a tax to the people in their community to generate that revenue. So going forward, we are not saying that there's a free lunch for everybody. North Dakotans understand, hey, listen, we have to pay for the services we get. We're taking this crazy amount of revenue that the state is wasting, and we're converting that to big reform. And going forward, we're still on the hook for any spending increases. But now we have a method which is more transparent, more understandable, and where citizens have a much better likelihood of having a say on whether that tax increase passes or not. In fact, I've had three occasions over the past year where a local elected official, different areas of the state, said their primary concern is that this will make it much easier for citizens to say no and prevent a tax increase.
Brings two questions to my mind, Dr. Becker. First, if the state replaces money as assessed in 2024, and then the community decides they need more, say in 2026, are they going to assess property taxes again? Where does this extra revenue come from?
Well, they'll have several options. Okay, so they cannot levy a valuation-based property tax. They could levy some other type of tax that could be associated with the property, say a flat fee per parcel, per lot. Someone in Fargo was talking about a square footage. Again, this is an opportunity for local elected officials to say, wow, here we go. We've got a new start. Let's figure something out, tailor it to the people in our community so it's the most fair, most transparent, best way to tax for services. Now, what I would do is implement, say, two taxes. One would be an infrastructure maintenance tax, and that would be obviously like a sidewalk repair, snow removal, things like that. Well, what I would do is assess that tax based on per parcel and then prorate it or include a variable of road frontage because that's the services you get. And then I would also do a municipal operations. That would be for general government, for health, for police, for fire. And that would go to every business, every residence, because it's going to an address. Would we call it a property tax? I don't know. Certainly not the way we consider what property tax is now. But people would be paying for the services they understand. So it's, again, it's much more. You can say, for instance, hey, listen, we have to increase your infrastructure maintenance because the snow plows are, we have to get new snow plows. Well, that's something that people can understand. They can say yes or no to. Your question is fully addressed in how this is going forward. There may be other ways that locals would like to do the taxing. But regardless of what it is, I want people to understand, instead of, because you're having this huge amount of relief, instead of paying $200, $300, $400 a month in your escrow for property taxes, you'd be looking at perhaps a monthly bill that could be put onto a utility bill from your local municipality for only the increased percentage of what their needs are. So instead of a $200 monthly bill, it might be, say, a $50 or $30 monthly bill.
Leads to my next question then. So the state replaces money as assessed in 2024. Your argument then is the state can do that forever, Dr. Becker?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell me why that is.
Well, number one, it's a flat amount, and the revenue for the state goes up every single year, which means that the amount to replace the property tax as a percentage of total revenue and as a percentage of total budget goes down every single year. If something like this had passed 15 years ago, for instance, we would be looking at an amount that's about $700 million instead of the billion. $1.4 billion. So it would be half as much. And I think that most people would say, well, gosh, it would be a lot easier right now if we only had to replace $700 million instead of $1.4 billion. And that's what's going to happen with this. As we move forward, it becomes less and less and less. Now, people say, well, you're relying on oil. Well, yes. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. We sure are, because we are relying on oil right now. Oil revenue accounts for about half of all of our revenue. Everything they're spending relies on oil. So the thing is, we know that oil is going to be around for 30, 40, 50 years. Harold Hamm says 50 years. I mean, the experts are investing such. And so what are we going to do for those next 30 to 50 years? Are we going to continue squandering this amazing opportunity from the resources North Dakota has? Or are we going to do something different, something that is to the benefit of our children and our grandchildren, something that drives as an incentive business to come to North Dakota, young families to come to North Dakota? We have two paths to take, and one is the status quo, so that one day when oil money is gone, we go back to North Dakota of the 1990s, where all we talked about was out-migration, how people were leaving the state, or we do something like this, which is truly legendary, and we take care of economic diversification, we take care of workforce development, and when that day comes when oil money goes away, we are now insulated from that event.
Dr. Becker, the governor talked also about taxing on large corporations and that this would eliminate property taxes assessed against those large corporations. He singly pointed out BNSF. He said, and I quote, "BNSF pays for every mile of railroad in the state. That thing passes. BNSF pays no property tax. Centrally assessed taxes on a pipeline is the biggest check that the county gets." Where does that extra money then come from? Or are you saying that it's just not needed?
Well, number one, well, first off, yes, I'm saying it's not needed. We're at the $1.3 billion per year. We have that much extra money, so it's not needed. Secondly, the overall, he's talking about, again, railroads, pipelines, electric transmission lines. These are centrally assessed properties. They account for a very, very small percentage of overall property taxes. Yes, you can pick out a specific county, Williams County, for example, where pipelines are a much bigger percentage of the total property taxes. Now, to the county, the state is replacing it either way, so it doesn't matter where it's coming from. In addition to that, what I would say is, unfortunately, these types of concerns that are brought up go to our more base concerns. Like, well, gosh, we don't want a bad guy, you know, whether our bad guy is a rich person or a big corporation or a railroad. We don't want them to get a break, so we are going to go against our own best interest and say no. That's unfortunate. But here's what I would say about railroads and pipelines and the electric transmission lines. They are currently centrally assessed ad valorem valuation-based property tax. We have a bill going in or bills going into the legislature in January that will convert them to in lieu of property tax, which means that they will continue to pay the taxes that they're paying now, but it's in a different format. So for instance, for some companies, transmission lines or telecommunications companies, I think their lines are at about $300 per mile that they pay. So there are ways to make sure that we continue receiving the revenue from those companies. That will not be lost. But I tell you, even if it was, the benefit that every citizen of North Dakota would receive, and yes, a small minority of property taxes are paid by these corporations, but if we're going to create a climate where we have an economic boon that benefits everybody, let's not be worried about whether a tiny percentage is going to some company. Chances are that that company, the Walmarts, the big boxes, are getting property tax breaks right now. 5, 10, 15 years of no property taxes. They're the ones getting a break. You and I are not getting the break. This measure makes it so we all get a break.
Dr. Becker, the governor talked about advocating and continuing then to reduce or eliminate state income tax and says, and I quote, "We could be close to joining the 10 other states that don't pay income tax. When we compete for energy workers," was the example he used, "we should also be a state that has no income tax." The threat there was, is okay, that's not going to happen if we eliminate property taxes. Do you agree with that?
Well, there'll be, I guess, less interest because the legislature, you know, has a very big interest in spending a lot of money. We could easily do away with property tax and income tax. Right now, I believe we are the lowest income tax state of all the states that have an income tax. Now, if you say, for example, you've got these energy workers and they're looking at moving and you let them know, hey, we've got about a 1 or 2% income tax, and we also have property tax. Which one is more likely to make you move to North Dakota? Not having to pay $200 in income tax to the state, or not having to pay $3,000 in property tax to the state? I can tell you which one they're going to pick.
Let me ask you this as we kind of wrap up our conversation, Dr. Becker. Governor criticized actually local governments for poor decision-making that drove property taxes higher despite state relief provided. He said, and I quote, if you keep subsidizing bad decisions locally, that'll keep happening. Well, you're replacing that money to the locals. So in a sense, spending, will that be impacted at all at the local level?
That part is an argument that I've had as well. When you subsidize anything, you get more of it. And the buy downs that the legislature has done in the past have been subsidizing local spending. And so you get more local spending. The difference, again, here is that we have dismantled the whole system of how they tax. So to subsidize or to buy down that system and then eliminate the system then eliminates that backfilling option. And again, we're converting. So when the locals want to raise taxes, the citizens are much more easily able to come in and say, hold on, what is this for? Do I want it? And are we going to allow this to pass? Very, very few people feel like they have that transparency or that access or that understanding for property tax.
Finally, Dr. Becker, the concept of renters don't get any relief here. Governor said, and I quote, if you're a renter and you don't own property, helps you? Nada, he said.
Yeah. Well, I know that Governor Burgum understands economics better than that. So it's unfortunate he is using those types of things. So renters pay property tax. It's built into their rent. There is no doubt about that. There's no argument there. So I have had, for instance, apartment building owners contact me and they're saying, this is great. I'm going to be able to make the improvements that I've been wanting to make but haven't been able to. So three things, one or more of three things will happen for renters. The most likely thing is that they will not see rent increases in the future because the no property tax, the number one expense for a landlord of an apartment building is property tax. That goes away. They suddenly are cash flowing much, much more. Now, I'm not suggesting that they're going to be super generous and say, you know what, I don't want this extra money. I'm going to give it back to my renters in the form of lower rent. Now, if they're in a highly competitive market, they may need to, or they're going to lose their tenants. So people could see their rent go down. The very likely scenario is they're not going to see these annual increases that they have been seeing year after year after year. That will go away. And then thirdly, yes, the landlords are going to have more cash flow so they can finally put in the better carpet, put in the new appliances, make the improvements so that the folks that are renting are in a better place. The other thing about renters is many people may choose to rent that they don't want the lifestyle of owning a home, but some people are renting because they're trying to get to a point where they can afford their first home. Not having property tax makes it more likely that they will be able to make that transition and afford their first home.
Does this at all impact specials that we hear so much about, Dr. Becker?
No, it doesn't. This does not affect specials. People don't like special assessments either, but there's only so much you can do in one measure. So this doesn't change bonding. Any bond that's there is still going to have to be paid off. Any bond that needs to be done in the future will still be able to be done, but it just cannot be tied to a valuation-based property tax.
We've been pleased to be joined by Dr. Rick Becker. He's the chairman of the End Unfair Property Tax Campaign. He is a proponent of Measure 4, which will be on the ballot this November 5th. Dr. Becker, if people need more information, where can they go?
We have a website, endpropertytax.com, endpropertytax.com. There is so much information there, good documents, good videos.
Dr. Becker, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
And a quick clarification from yesterday's show. I indicated that property taxes are collected by the state and then redistributed to local governments. In fact, the state does not collect property taxes. They are collected by local subdivisions through the county. Our thanks to Jeff Esslinger from the North Dakota Association of Counties for that clarification. Coming up in the second half today, it's Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
the great walk-up music to Prairie Plates means it's Wednesday here on Main Street. Pleased to be welcoming Rick Guillon back with us. Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. You attended an event and interviewed Beth Dooley this past weekend relative to farm-to-table work and also regional cookbook authors. I want to play that for our listeners right now, and then we'll reflect about it on the return.
I'm here today at a farm-to-table event north of Moorhead with James Beard award-winning author Beth Dooley. Beth, it's good to see you today.
Oh, I love being here. What a beautiful day, too. Yeah, it's just great. And the farm is packed with all these people that are curious about what happens on a farm.
Tell us a little bit about what you're up to today.
Well, I just finished cooking a bunch of local vegetables with some poached eggs on top, and it's a Middle Eastern dish called shakshuka. And it's fabulous, and it's so easy. And all I did was saute a bunch of local veg that included zucchini and these beautiful tiny grape tomatoes. And then we had lots of garlic and lots of onions and some kale and some zucchini and some peppers. We cooked them all down in some olive oil, a little salt and pepper. We added a bunch of cumin, and then we plopped some eggs on top and poached them. And that was a breakfast, one of the healthiest breakfasts you can have, because you get all those great vegetables, and then you also get the protein from the eggs. And the eggs, because they're sort of poached, they're not really fully hard cooked, become the sauce for those vegetables. And then you've got nice sourdough bread that we use to dip it in. Super easy and really fun.
I've had shakshuka a few times at Burn Bombs, and I can tell you it's really good, and this one looked really, really good, because you kind of put a little bit of ginger and a few other ingredients in it that made it a little more interesting, I'd say.
Yeah, well, we're lucky, because today Lonnie and Sandy Dietz from Whitewater Farm came up, and they brought local ginger. They actually grow ginger in a hoop house down in southern Minnesota. They're fabulous farmers. So we're seeing so many different things growing here that we've never had before, and I find that terribly exciting.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about farm-to-table cooking, farm-to-table restaurants, that sort of thing. You're from the Twin Cities.
I'm from the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think all the regions in the state are really becoming hip to all the things we can grow here and source locally. And it's really important for a variety of reasons. The first is that it's going to taste better if it's grown locally and if it's grown in good soil. You know, if it's not traveling thousands of miles across the country or millions of miles from around the world, it's going to be fresher. So that's going to make a difference. The other thing is, especially with vegetables, we know that the more nutritious the soil, the better tasting the vegetable is going to be, and the better it is for our bodies. It's going to have more nutrients, and growing things that way is better for the soil. We need good topsoil, and when you grow things that way, you're going to lose less of it into the Red River or Mississippi River, which is growing the dead zone, and you're capturing carbon, and you're sheltering pollinators and wildlife, and so you're really improving the environment too. And the smaller farmers and the farmers that are using what's now called regenerative practices grow diverse kinds of plants on their land in rotation, which is different than growing just corn and soy, which are monocrops, which require tilling every year. That disrupts the soil, it releases carbon into the atmosphere, and we lose soil that way. So this way of farming is really good for everything, our flavors, our bodies, and our earth.
A lot of positives there. Let's switch now to talk about cookbooks. You've written and co-authored numerous cookbooks. Can you talk a little bit about that, and then maybe working with famous chef Sean Sherman, who I've interviewed too, and just some of those writing projects?
It's really fun. You know, I'm a home cook and I'm a writer, so I've learned so much from these chefs that I work with, because my interest really primarily is in flavor, and I want to know how these professional chefs are able to create these dishes that are just so delicious and boldly seasoned. And so my work with these chefs chefs is to translate what they're doing in their kitchen where they're cooking for lots and lots of people. And I'm only cooking for 4 to 6 at the most, right? How do I reduce those recipes and make them accessible to the average home cook so I can share with them some of the tips and tricks and hints that I've learned from these chefs to bolster flavors and cook better food. And the thing I learned from Sean, and I loved cooking with him, he's such an interesting person and such a wonderful historian because he knows the history of our region before colonials arrived, before things really changed. And so he's very good at identifying and sourcing truly local food, foods that are indigenous to this area that grew here before Europeans arrived. And what I find fascinating is you go out for a foraging walk with Sean and you realize how much food we walk over every day, how much food I step on when I step out of my house. And we were testing recipes one day and he said, well, I think this needs a little juniper. And I thought, oh, shoot, I forgot to get juniper from the store. And he goes, it's right out your front door. It's right there. So, you know, it's things like that that really opened my eyes to, you know, how bountiful our region really is when we think we don't have good local food. We've got a lot of it.
Anything recent or new that you've been working on that you'd like people to know about?
Yeah, you know, the book that I just wrote, I've got a couple. One is called Perennial Kitchen, which we're featuring here today because that's another farm-to-table book. But that focuses on some of the, quote, newer crops that we're finding in the market. So that's some of the heritage varieties of dried beans and the heritage wheat that we're milling into flour to make into breads that really has a wonderful flavor. We're also focusing on some of those perennial plants and the way that the University of Minnesota is perennializing sunflowers for oil and for seeds, those kinds of things. And that's, you know, that's out. And then I also have one that just came out called Appetite for Change. And that's with a community in North Minneapolis where it's, you know, considered an area without much fresh local food, when in fact there are a number of citizens there that have started this organization called Appetite for Change and using food as a tool to build health, wealth, and social change in their community. So they've launched a number of youth gardens and they're selling the food that they're growing in the youth gardens in the little farmers market they have, and then they're also using it in their food truck to sell it that way. And it's also it's a youth-run enterprise, basically, where the youth are learning service, and they're learning business, and they're also learning how to grow food. So it's an exciting project, and that one's called Appetite for Change. And I have one coming out in November, and that's called Chili, Clove, and Cardamom, which was fascinating because that is with Gary Paul Nabom, who's an ethnobotanist out of Arizona. And we're focused on the seasonings and the herbs that are grown in hot, dry places. He is an incredible researcher about a lot of these plants that have come from the Middle East and from the Far East and ended up in the Americas. And then a lot of those plants in the Americas from hot, dry areas and deserts that have traveled to the East. So, you know, my sort of theories are, you know, buy and cook locally and season globally, which is what we did today, right? Because we don't have to just use salt and pepper. I mean, those aren't spices in my mind. So, you know, we can reach out. You know, food is really the initial form of currency.
It is.
Around the world.
It is.
So how do we sort of bring that sensibility but enjoy what we have here and then also trade, you know, our sensibilities with these other cultures?
A lot of good stuff here today. Beth Dooley, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you. Thanks so much. What a fun day. Thank you.
Rick, what stood out to you most, I guess, during your conversation with Beth Dooley about farm-to-table cooking and regenerative food practices?
I think, number one, she's extremely passionate about food. She's extremely passionate about farm-to-table. She's extremely passionate about good ingredients. And I think you'll find that in a lot of really good chefs these days. She's written a dozen cookbooks, and maybe our audience isn't really familiar with Beth Dooley. She's does a lot down in the Twin Cities, Minnesota area, but she definitely understands Midwest cooking, Midwest fare, and the people, if you didn't guess that from the interview there. So yes, I think she's just very passionate about cooking in general, but ingredients for sure.
She spoke really passionately, I thought, about new crops and community projects, such as her book, Appetite for Change. And what impact do you think these projects have on food justice and sustainability based on her comments?
Yeah, and this event was called Our Local Plate Farm Fest and Market. So it kind of gives you an idea, and it was north of Moorhead, specifically north of Cragness, Minnesota, just kind of across the border, really. And it kind of gives you an idea of where she's at with those things. And food justice is a huge issue, especially with certain populations that don't have access to fresh produce. And there are actually some community gardens here in Fargo, 9 of them specifically, that belong to one group that do things like that, help certain populations grow this fresh produce that's healthy and vibrant. And it's really creating a culture here in the eastern side of the state that I haven't really seen maybe a decade prior, definitely 20 years prior. I mean, there's definitely this farm-to-table growth in the state of North Dakota, and it's just really, really great to see.
She spoke about her collaboration with renowned chefs like Sean Sherman, who you've had the opportunity to visit with.
Yeah.
It's really kind of shaped her perspective, and I think I hear you saying it's really influencing perspective on cooking here in the region.
I think it is, and another chef of note who's been on Main Street is Chef Candace Stock from Burn Bombs, and she also gave a cooking demonstration at this event, some buckwheat pancakes with some foraged goods and some local berries and stuff like that. And she's getting to be a well-known indigenous chef here in Fargo-Moorhead. So that's really fun to see these indigenous sort of food ways developing a little bit more, or at least just getting out to the general public and so people know about these things.
You have other regional cookbook authors on a list that you've kind of curated here. Sarah yeah. Watson is one of them.
Sarah Watson is just fantastic. She and I kind of go back a little ways here, and she's just put out a cookbook a couple years ago. It's in limited supply, I believe. Maybe Creative Kitchen just has a few copies left. I know they're sold out at the Plains Art Museum, but it's a really good cookbook called The Cabin Chef, and she's from the FM area here, and she and her husband are pretty well known in the food scene here. Another one in the Park Rapids, Minnesota area is Amy Thielen, and she's won James Beard Award, and she's put out various cookbooks. She used to cook in high-end restaurants on the East Coast, and so there's a really good list here. I'm just going to kind of go over it, Craig, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's great. The next one is really kind of important to us, I guess, our family. Molly A., certainly most people know who she is from the East Grand Forks area, has her own restaurant there, Charlie's.
Bernie's.
Bernie's has her own restaurant, Bernie's. And my granddaughter, at a very young age, kind of became hooked on her shows that she was watching, and now has her cookbooks. And it's family time with mom cooking from Molly Ye's cookbooks.
I think people just love Molly. She's just really charming, great personality, but she really knows food. She's very passionate about food.
Does she? Yes.
Yes. And she's extremely knowledgeable, and she's actually coming out with a new cookbook. I think she has 3 prior, but a new one called Sweet Farm, because she lives on a sugar beet farm. So why not call it Sweet Farm? And it's about a bunch of goodies. And she's very well known for her baked goods, so it's very appropriate.
Our friend Sue Balcom is on your list, Rick.
Sue Balcom has done a lot with Germans from Russia Foodways in the Bismarck Mandan area, and has been a part of some of these programs that we put out there, Germans from Russian Food. And one of the big things is a cookbook called Gutes Essen, which we're a part of, Prairie Public here. And she wrote a few parts of it, and she's just become kind of an expert, or is an expert in that area. Germans from Russia, obviously a big part of North Dakota culture here. She needed to be a part of this list. So,
oh, for sure. Root Cellar Sue.
Yes.
Love Sue.
We miss her. The next one on the list here is Megan Myrdal, Noreen Thomas, Peter Schultz, etc., because there's a few other authors in this book. They came together, and it's called Midwest Mediterranean, and I think this was put out maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, and a lot of these folks take trips to Greece every year, which I need to find out a way to get in on one of these trips, because they just sound great. But
don't they, though?
Yeah. And Greek food is just amazing, and it's simple, but the ingredients are fresh. That's the key. Healthy eating, fresh ingredients, and a lot of olive oil and that sort of thing. It's intriguing. There are recipes, but there's more background. There's more nutritional aspects. There's more cultural aspects. And so that book is pretty comprehensive, but it is local and kind of a fun one to read. The next person works for Form Communications, and I really enjoy her stuff. She isn't really a cookbook author per se, but I like reading her pieces in the Forum or Form Communications newspapers. That's Tracy Briggs, because she gets into a lot of food history, background, certain things like that. And she's just a really sweet person and really passionate about good food. And then the last one on the list, and this cookbook is mysterious, and those in the know what I'm talking about, but Andrea Baumgartner, and she's a 2-time James Beard semifinalist, runs Burn Bombs here in downtown Fargo, but supposedly there's a cookbook coming out with some of those recipes from Burn Bombs, and that's been in the works for quite a while now, so that's why I call it mysterious, but I think there will be a large celebration once that cookbook comes out.
Absolutely, Rick. You'll have to let us know when that becomes available.
Oh, I will. There's a lot going on with food in this region, and it's just great to see.
Rick Gion joins us each and every week here at Prairie Public on Wednesdays, makes us hungry with his Prairie Plates. Thanks for joining us again, Rick.
You bet, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
On today's episode of Poetry from Studio 47, we feature Patricia Smith, the selected poem 10-year-old shot 3 times, but she's fine, offers a haunting exploration of gun violence and its devastating impact on children and communities.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Patricia Smith. Smith was born on June 25, 1955, in Chicago, Illinois. After high school, she attended Southern Illinois University and Northwestern University before going on to receive an MFA from the University of Southern Maine, Stone Coast. Smith first got interested in poetry due to the theater, and in fact, many of her poems also originated from Chicago's vibrant slam poetry scene. Her books include Life According to Motown, Big Town's Big Talk, Close to Death, Tea House of the Almighty, Blood Dazzler, and Incendiary Art, which are poems about the murder of Emmett Till. Smith has received a wide range of awards and honors, including the Carl Sandburg Literary Award, the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Poetry, the NAACP Image Award, and she has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Smith has also received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim Foundation, and she has been a 4-time National Poetry Slam champion. She teaches at the College of Staten Island, as well as Sierra Nevada University's MFA program. Today's poem is 10-year-old shot 3 times, but she's fine. I do not need to tell you that the level of gun violence in America is both unique and horrifying. Those in the African American community know this raw fact only too well. Even as you hear this broadcast, I am sure that our fellow citizens are dying due to our love of guns. There is so much collateral damage and pain happening in our country. We have much work to do, especially when it comes to children getting caught in the crossfire. This is 10-year-old shot 3 times, but she's fine, by Patricia Smith. dumbfounded in hospital whites. You are picture book itty bitty, floundering in bleach and steel. Braids untwirl and corkscrew. You squirm. The crater in your shoulder spews a soft voltage. On a TV, screwed into the wall above your head, neon rollicks. A wide-eyed train engine perfectly smokes, warbles a song about forward. Who shot you, baby? I don't know, I was playing. You didn't see anyone? I was playing with my friend Sharon. I was on the swing, and she was, are you sure you didn't? No, I ain't seen nobody but Sharon. I heard people yelling, though, and... Each bullet repainted you against the brick, kicked you a little sideways, made you need air differently. You leaked something that still goldens the boulevard. I ain't seen nobody, I told you. And at A. Lincoln Elementary on Washington Street, or Jefferson Elementary on Madison Street, or Adams Elementary just off the Eisenhower Expressway, we gather the ingredients, if not the desire, for pathos. An imploded homeroom, your empty seat pulsating with drooped celebrity, the sometime counselor underpaid and elsewhere, a harried teacher struggling toward your full name. Anyway, your grades weren't all that good. No need to coo or encircle anything. No call for anyone to pull their official white fingers through your raveled hair. No reason to introduce the wild notion of loving you, loud and regardless. Oh, and they finally located your mama, who will soon burst in with her cut-rate cure of stammering Jesus' name. Beneath the bandages, your chest crawls shut. Perky old Thomas winks a bold-faced lie from his clacking track, and your heart monitor hums a wry tune no one will admit they've already heard. Elsewhere, 23 seconds rumble again and again through Sharon's body. Boom, boom, she says, to no one.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks and produced by Peter Folliard. We both send our best wishes. Thank you for listening.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 18th. The Homestead Act of 1862 placed land in the hands of men and women willing to work hard to realize their American dream. Any qualified person who lived on the claim for 5 years and improved it could claim 160 acres for a small filing fee. The act applied to any person, meaning women and freed slaves were eligible. At the end of 5 years, the claimant could pay the sum of $18 to earn ownership of the 160 acres. Many people staked out land and successfully proved their claims. However, others did not. On this date, in 1909, the Dickinson Press reported on one old pioneer who did not believe his land was worth the $18 it would cost to claim it. W.J. Kirby was an early settler who established himself on land near New England. In 1887, Kirby moved his family from Vermont to settle along the Cannonball River. Though Kirby was not a farmer by nature, he was a carpenter, he contributed to building many structures in New England, including the newspaper office, the Union Congressional Church, and his own home. By 1888, the building boom in the area had ended, and there was little demand for a carpenter. Kirby shifted his focus to raising sheep and cattle. As a successful rancher, he surprised his neighbors when he abruptly pulled up stakes and moved west. He did not have much faith in the financial future of the area and chose to save the $18 it would cost to finalize the claim. He packed up his family and relocated to the West Coast. Kirby had no idea that the land he left behind would increase in value. By 1909, small lots in the town were being sold for $300 each, and old settlers who sold their full claims were making a considerable profit. When New England resident E.E. Cook visited Kirby in Washington, the old pioneer was quite surprised to learn that he had missed out on a profitable opportunity. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent part of your Wednesday with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll see what Matt Olean thinks about the biodoc movie Reagan, and we'll hear about the University of North Dakota's Center for Innovation. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary with a special event. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday, and we'll see you back here tomorrow on Main Street.